Didn't bother to catch the words. Instead, she put her elbow on the metal armrest and peered out her window, the noisy clatter of the rails changing to a gentle metallic purr as her train emerged into the outside air from the depths of Manhattan. The woman was right. The city landscape looked dramatically different from even 15 minutes ago, when the lowering sun still lit the sky as she'd entered Penn Station. But unlike the woman behind her, she didn't mind. Each year, she waited with growing impatience for fall to come and the days to grow shorter. She loved how street lamps and traffic signals, headlamps on cars and flashlights on phones became weak substitutes for daylight. They aimed to make the night appear tame and restrained, like a tiger tucked behind a glass enclosure at the zoo. But their power was an illusion. Nobody controlled the night. The best you could do was make it your friend. Mia tucked her collarbone-length brown hair behind her ears and pressed her forehead against the window, cupping the sides of her eyes with her hands to block the glare from the train's overhead fixture. That was one of the lessons her grandmother had taught her when she was little, that the night could be a fine friend, but only if you understood all it offered. Growing up, she'd had many friends who were scared of the dark. Their parents were too, it seemed. Many families in town kept their porch lights on all night, and when she'd go on sleepovers, she was amazed at the plethora of night lights in bathrooms and hallways, even in the bedrooms where she and her friends slept. But her grandmother had always craved the dark. She'd claimed that lamps, chandeliers, and so on were unpleasant and unhelpful with their harsh bulbs and the distracting shadows they threw.
"The night sky is bright if you look closely,"
she'd say.
"It tells you exactly where you need to go."
Mia's phone rang, disturbing her memories, and she bit her lip as she looked at her bag on the seat next to her. She hoped it was her friend Erica confirming that she'd be at the station near the ticket machines at 7:30, waiting to pick her up so they could head to dinner. But when she pulled out her phone, the number was Ryan's. She hesitated before putting the phone to her ear. "Hey," she said, trying to sound pleased. "Where are you? At the airport?"
"About to board,"
he told her.
"And you?"
"On the train."
"Will you go straight to the house?"
"No, Erica's picking me up. We're going to get dinner, then she'll drop me off." There was a pause, and then Ryan continued.
"You sure you want to do this?"
Mia pressed her lips together, stifling her sigh so he wouldn't hear it. "I have to," she said. "I can't let the house keep sitting there."
"But I'll be back soon. 2 weeks won't make a difference.
I can be there with you. That's what boyfriends are for, you know." He chuckled and then went on, more serious now.
"You don't have to do this alone. You don't need to prove anything."
"I'm not trying to prove anything," she told him.
They'd been over this a lot.
Ryan liked being needed, and it bothered him that she didn't want him to come with her when she returned to the house for the first time since her grandmother died. "I want to spend the night there by myself," she added. "Then tomorrow I'll meet up with Erica again, and Saturday we leave for the Adirondacks." She waited, sure he was going to protest further. But thankfully, a voice in the background announced the last boarding call for Flight 1642 to Los Angeles. "Is that yours?" she asked.
"Yeah,"
he answered, resignation in his voice.
"Okay, look. Make sure to get the exact measurements for the 2 upstairs bedrooms and the hall. I can't make out the handwriting on the old floor plans you picked up from town hall, and I want to be able to talk intelligently with the architect if we decide to break down that wall. And make sure the gardener cleared the leaves. You want the place to look nice, no matter what you decide to do with it. And set a timer on the hall light, for God's sake.
There's no...